Actian Zen Database is the best-in-class, single, secure, scalable architecture for edge data management. It's the perfect solution for software developers who want dedicated application data management and deliver business-critical products and services into OT and low IT environments. Customizable installation, self-tuning, seamless backward compatibility, minimal memory requirements, and exceptionally low support requirements. And better performance than most alternatives like SQLite, all means that you can deliver applications to customers at scale across a wide range of platforms. With direct access from C++, Python, and other popular languages, Zen's simple set of APIs significantly expands the pools of developers capable of building their next business-critical application on Actian Zen. Try it today at actian.com/zen. That's actian.com/zen.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes. Today I'm talking with Ali Spittle. She is a software developer and developer advocate over at Dev2. That's dev.to. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm doing all right. Thanks for chatting with me today. I was following a really cool thread that you have going on Twitter where you asked a bunch of people, specifically new programmers, what were their biggest questions about learning how to code? Why are you exploring how new developers think about learning how to code?
Totally. So for me, I started off programming in a really untraditional way. I wasn't a computer science major. I started coding a little bit older than a lot of developers that I know. And it was something that was pretty difficult for me. I ended up quitting coding after taking two computer science classes in college. And I just thought that coding wasn't for me. And so I totally walked away from it and then came back to it a little bit later. And so I know that that was such a hard process for me to learn how to code and to feel accepted in the developer community. So it's something that I'm really passionate about now. I ended up teaching people how to code full-time at a boot camp for a year and a half. And now I am still trying to teach as much as I can, even though I moved back to a software engineering position.
Mm-hmm. And you've taken a bunch of these concepts and you've broken them down. It's kind of cool. I've never seen this before. It's quite clever. You asked the question on Twitter and then they answered. And then you actually did something that I recommend to a lot of people rather than answering the question on Twitter and effectively giving Twitter your keystrokes for free. You took the questions and answers and put them on your blog and then linked back to it. So every time someone asked a question, you would say, oh, I answered it over here. Very clever.
Yeah, mostly just because Twitter is so temporary. And also having some place that I can link this back in the future is really helpful.
Yeah, and it's like Twitter may go away someday, but your blog post will be there forever.
Totally.
Yeah. One of the things that I've noticed, and I know that you've been exploring this as well, is how to break down problems. And I'm trying to get my head around what's intuitive and what's inborn, and like what I find intuitive might not be what someone else finds intuitive. Do you think you were born able to break problems down like quote unquote like a coder, or did you learn that?
So I think one of the biggest problems for programmers is to be able to like teach yourself and solve things for yourself. And so I was homeschooled growing up, and I think that that was actually a really big part of how I am a strong programmer, because I had to teach myself a lot of the skills growing up and teaching myself math and teaching myself English and all those things. And I think that that's really translated well into programming and problem solving in that way. So I think that definitely the education system plays a huge role into that, and the different education that people have access to is really, really huge there. And I do think that the fundamental math concepts really play a big role into this. And as interesting it is to think about, like most of programming or a huge chunk of programming is basic algebra. And actually teaching people how to code, that's something that I've seen lacking in a lot of students. And so I think that those skills tend to come in big part from the education system. That being said, I also think that certain people do like breaking things apart and putting them back together, but then other people do are more interested in having a pre-made solution that they take, which I think are actually both really important skills for programmers. Like building stuff for yourself is really important to some extent, but then also knowing where to go outside of yourself and find a solution that's already been made for you is also pretty important.
Mm-hmm. I had this conversation with Maria on my team, and I bring it up often in podcasts because it was really very clever. We were teaching each other some techniques, and it was my turn to teach aspects of .NET and C#. And I started at a very low level, showing her the intermediate language, the assembly language that .NET compiled into. And I basically taught the way I was taught, which is from the metal up. And she stopped me and said, I don't like to learn about the metal. Like, the metal doesn't matter anymore. I'm really more interested about learning from the glass of the monitor back. And I'm like, what do you mean by the glass? And I was like, well, you know, press F12 in the browser and then go backwards, and I'll go as far back as I want to until it becomes not interesting. Right.
Oh,
does
wow.
she need to know about, yeah, it's kind of cool, huh? Does she need to know about CPU registers and stuff? Like, memory management for me meant, you know, allocating your own memory in C, but memory management today is more like JavaScript memory management, which is very, very different.
Totally. So I think that it can be important for contextual knowledge, like knowing why you use different data structures based off of memory usage and stuff like that, like why you'd use a linked list in certain scenarios and an array in others. So I think that it's helpful in that context, but that's actually where I left computer science is, I had done really well with the Python and higher level programming classes where it's a lot of just putting the pieces together and building stuff fast. But then when I got to C++ and learning about pointers and all that, it was a little bit less relevant to me. I don't think I ever really got like, why were you learning this? If we know how to use Python, like why would we use C++? Mm-hmm. But now looking back on it, I very much understand that. But at that point, I didn't have that context to know why knowing that was important. And I just had more fun with Python. So I'd rather write code with that at that point.
When I was growing up, my father would not let me drive an automatic stick car. He required me to drive a manual stick because his argument was like, well, the automatic is fine, but it's hiding something from you. So you need to learn to drive a stick because one day you'll need to drive a stick. And that actually, you know, happened. There's been times when it was like I was the only one in the group that could drive a stick, and it got us out of weird situations. But at the same time, now fast forward, now we have like Uber, and we're like, how many more level? Like, there's from subways to taxis to Ubers. How many layers of abstraction have we put on top of the manual stick car? So then we become this culture where we have the people who can drive stick, and the people who don't even have driver's licenses. I wonder if the same thing will happen in software where we have like the no's and the no knots or the low level stick shift driving people and the Uber driving people, and if that creates a caste system.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, thinking about it, so many people specialize in so many different fields. Like I know so many awesome developers that write HTML and CSS, and that's pretty much it. And so if you're working in mostly those languages, is it super, super helpful to know about assembly and how binary works and how, you know, the CPU is going on? Maybe it's still helpful, but maybe it's more important to focus on accessibility and how CSS is interpreted by the browser and all that. So there's so many different niches that you can really narrow down into your own and have your more important information there.
So is your advice to a new programmer to like not be stressed out about how much stuff there is to memorize and just think about the fact that there are these niches and you can just focus on the one that's interesting to you and really not sweat the other stuff?
Yeah, I'm a pretty big like don't memorize anything person. I personally am not somebody with the best memory in the world. I definitely focus more on being able to look stuff up, being able to break down a problem accurately, being able to ask the questions that matter so that you know what a problem really is and what the client actually wants from a project. I think that all those things and working with a team and all that is a lot more important than having anything memorized in order to recite something back by memory to somebody.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that there's just so much stuff now, maybe that there was less stuff in the 80s or different stuff, than certain generations are expected to like learn the whole stack, and the whole stack is so much more to memorize that it's slowing people down and making new devs like too afraid to jump in?
Maybe. I also think that the availability of information right now, too, is so incredible, where you can look pretty much anything up and have an answer there in a couple seconds. I think knowing that is so important. And I think in general, our education system like really needs to move to a point where they're accepting of that and classes aren't just memorize these things anymore. But I guess that's a different answer there.
Well, no, but I think that you've brought up the education system a couple of times. We can't really talk too much about that, but we can talk about let's talk about the concept of code smell or just general factual smell. Like you just made the comment that there's lots of stuff online that people can go and find and download, you know, but then there's a difference between using the internet and the sum of human knowledge to get an answer and then copy pasting directly from Stack Overflow into production. You know what I mean? Like there's a fine line there. So I feel like some of the new devs maybe are having trouble telling whether something is true or not, or whether this is appropriate code, because it was the first thing on Google. It must be the best way to use a linked list, right?
Yeah, definitely. So it's definitely overcoming that. And instead of Googling a whole problem, Googling the parts of the problem that you can't solve yourself. So instead of searching, how do I make a tic-tac-toe game in JavaScript, which I know a lot of new developers might do, instead it's how do you have a button that you can click on and have some other user interaction based off that button click. Like having the individual pieces that you can Google and find the answer to what a string method is or something like that is so important. But then being able to break down that problem and solve those pieces individually is still so important. And I think that's what programmers need to focus on, is being able to solve those problems, being able to break them into pieces, being able to research those pieces individually. I think that's the really important part.
That's a good point. And that gets to your point about breaking down pieces of a problem into the right chunks. I wonder if you and I Google for different stuff than the new people do. Like maybe they are Googling for bigger things of bigger scope or bigger full-on solution type stuff, while you and I are looking for syntax and, you know, I know what I'm doing. I just don't know how to hook the button up here.
Totally. And that's why I'm kind of writing the series that I'm working on right now. So I'm working on a project where I'm taking a bunch of different aspects to problem solving and breaking them down for developers and showing my process and my advice for how to approach these things and what questions to ask and what strategies to follow in order to find the right solutions to problems. And one of my things for a little bit in learning, and not for forever, but maybe at some point make yourself a cheat sheet with all the syntax that you might need for your language, and then turn off the internet for a while and only write code on your computer. And not for forever, but just for a little bit, so that you're solving these problems by yourself, you're putting together the pieces, and coding isn't a research problem. It's a problem-solving problem.
I wonder if there was a way or if we could do a survey to find out the average time spent coding in between Googling sessions.
That's a really good question. Yeah, for sure.
And what would that tell us? Like, again, I don't want to draw any qualitative conclusions or imply that one person is better or lesser, but there must be a type of person who spends, you know, an hour or two coding, and then they Google something, and then they come back. And then there must be another person who's spending an hour Googling and 5 minutes coding. And what can we learn about that? And how can we use that information to help everyone?
Totally. And I think I would fall on both sides of the spectrum, depending on what I'm building, too. If I'm building something in a language I'm super familiar with, and I have been familiar with this problem and solved something familiar in the past, then I might be the person that's not Googling things for long periods of time. But if it's something that's brand new to me, like I'd probably be Googling more.
That's a really great point. I recently hooked up this keyboard that's got like these LEDs in the keys to show my blood sugar. And they wanted me to do it in Node, which I'm not good at. And I swear I spent like 2 hours looking for how to make a request in Node, because I found 5011 ways to do it. And I couldn't tell which one was right. But if I was doing it in C#, I would not be doing that at all. I would have spent many less hours Googling for that, simply because I was not familiar. Not just that I wasn't familiar, but also that there was no clear answer. That was the tough part. Everyone had an opinion about how to make an HTTP request in JavaScript, and they were all different.
Yeah, I think the JavaScript ecosystem is fascinating in that way, that there are so many ways of doing things that are pretty much correct at this point, but there's just a lot of ways of doing anything with all the different frameworks that are out there.
That's funny that you point that out, that it is so many ways that are, like you just said, there are correct. Like, I was looking for the way, like the way and the light and the truth. You're saying that like they were probably all correct, and that's scary.
Yeah, I think so. Just there are so many things that are out there that you could totally use to make a valid HTTP request and have it work perfectly fine. But maybe there are different trade-offs. Like, are you looking for something more efficient? Are you looking for a lightweight library? Are you looking for something that's developer-friendly? Those are all the trade-offs that come into it.
Well, let's talk about those. So just in a few seconds, you rattled off like some very thoughtful software engineering type questions about like stuff. But how does a beginner move past a tutorial and move into those kind of smart questions? Because sometimes when you go to an interview, they ask you the question and then you freeze because it's like, I don't know the right answer. But really the right answer is the five questions that you just rattled off. Well, it kind of depends.
Totally. And I think that answering the question with more questions is sometimes the way to go at it. I think that interviews are a tough format in general just because you're under pressure. And I don't think clearly when I'm under pressure at all. I definitely could solve questions way better outside of a high pressure situation. But that being said, I think that coming at it from those different perspectives is really important. That's something that I want to bring to new developers. Like whenever I'm teaching, I always say that teaching the syntax or any of that is not what's important to me in this. Like it's, you do have to be able to build stuff, but what's a lot more important to me is that you know what questions to ask and how to teach yourself how to code at the end of me teaching you. Because, you know, I can teach you so much about this one thing, but who knows what you're actually going to be doing once you get out there. And so it's way more important that you can take what you learn here and apply it to something else rather than actually knowing just the one way to do things.
Hired, the leading career marketplace for software engineers, will match you with your next job. Based on your skills, experience, and desired salary, they'll intelligently match you with over 10,000 companies who are looking for engineers just like you. Better yet, you don't even need to apply. Just create a profile and let leading companies such as WeWork, Dropbox, Wayfair, Zillow, and more apply directly to you. Join Hired today at hired.com/Hanselminutes. That's Hired, hired.com/Hanselminutes.
So how do we teach that to new devs? You teach new devs. You've taught them at General Assembly. You've taught them all over. How do you, like, I was teaching my son how to code, and then something, we bumped into an issue, and the issue wasn't the code. It wasn't the syntax. It was like the DNS server was messed up. That's not at all what we were trying to do. So what do you do if you're a full-time dev and you've been involved in dev for 2 or 3 years and then you're just now learning how DNS works, which is part of infrastructure? Like suddenly you're driving in an Uber and now you need to drive a stick shift.
Yeah, it's tough. I think a lot of that's researching and having those skills to research stuff and also just the ability to stick with it. I know, like, I've been writing code for, I guess, 6 years now, and just last week, I was trying to debug a CSS issue that wasn't actually a CSS issue. I forgot to close an HTML tag. And it's things like that that really get you because you're thinking, why isn't my CSS working? Like, it's definitely the CSS, but it isn't at all. So I think a lot of it's just sticking with it and keeping trying things, looking at different things, looking at things from different angles, and knowing that sometimes it'll take some time and sometimes it'll be really annoying, but if you stick with it, it will eventually get there. And then another thing is being willing to ask people questions, because at some point, maybe somebody else is going to be able to solve that question in a couple of minutes, whereas for you, it might be worth it to learn that new thing and put that time into it, but maybe it's more worth it to just have somebody else solve that piece of the problem.
I think also it's important for people to know that, you know, old timers like me or experienced programmers like yourself bump into this stuff all the time. And we have to get to that point ourselves, and we have to get the junior engineers to the point where they can feel that they can, in a safe place, say, hey, I did this thing and it was a silly, fun error. Let's laugh about it and learn from it, as opposed to beating ourselves up about that. Like, another person might beat themselves up about the missing angle bracket. But we all are like listening and going, oh, yep, we've all had the $1 million semicolon, or I commented that code out or whatever. And we've spent hours staring at it and it was like a checkbox or a missing slash.
Totally. I think the idea of having a safe place to fail is super important, and having a place that isn't immediately putting on the pressure in a situation that there doesn't need to be a lot of pressure. So giving time to do assignments when you're being onboarded, or knowing that certain things will take way less time than you think they will, and some things will take a lot more time than you think they will. And having that place where it's not always a super high pressure environment, and you do have the ability to go down the wrong road, come back and try a different path. I think that that's really important in an educational environment, but also in a work environment.
Yeah. And optimizing the amount of time that you like, I always believe in fail fast, fail often. So if I can avoid spending like 17 hours debugging an issue that ends up being a missing semicolon, like I'd like to do that. But I do also want it to take a little bit of time. Like I should waste an hour trying to learn, because there's a learning opportunity there. You know what I mean? So there's that sweet spot of this took a long time and I figured it out versus this completely crushed my spirit and destroyed my momentum and I figured it out.
Totally. I think that like hour rule is a pretty good one. If it's taking about an hour, then keep working on it yourself. But if you're past that hour mark, try to reach out to somebody else for a second pair of eyes.
Mm-hmm. Have you noticed, as you've probably taught people of varying ages and across generations, that I'm starting to notice that people Google, and I'm using Google in the general, like searching the internet term, people Google differently than other people. I'm noticing my sons, which are teenagers, Google full and complete sentences. Like they ask Google a question as if it is a person, like, how do I, and I don't know if Google is that good at answering full and complete sentences, because it's looking for the word how and do I and da 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 da. And I think they may not be getting the right answers. Do you think that new devs or devs that are like coming up in the last 4 or 5 years tend to do that, while old timers do the whole keyword Google search? And how much is Google searching or learning how to search a useful thing to learn?
Interesting. So I actually almost would have noticed the opposite in my experience. But I think definitely most developers that are successfully Googling things, I think, are doing the kind of keyword, here's my error, and this is what it's saying, and then here's the programming language, and that's it. Mm-hmm. That's kind of the best way that I've found to find answers. As far as Googling, I would get familiar with some of the tricks for Google, like that you can search things in quotation marks in order to get an exact quote. You can do a specific site search. All those kind of tips and tricks can make your Googling process a little bit more helpful. So I think that that can be good as well.
That's a really good point. I wonder if that'll go in your course on moving past tutorials that you're going to put up at dev.to.
Yeah, definitely. That's something that I definitely want to include in there, is a kind of guideline for how to Google different issues, and then also what tips and tricks can make your Googling process easier.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I keep coming back to that concept of smell, right? Like, you don't know how you develop your sense of smell, but it just happens. And it's like, I may not know Python like you know Python, and you may not know C sharp like I know C sharp, but I bet you that we could both look at some code and we could go, it doesn't really smell right. I don't know why, but it smells wrong. And then if we went searching for something on the internet, we could also feel that the search results didn't smell right. Like, I should have found it. It must be that I typed this search term wrong. And I, you know, because you feel in your soul that the answer is out there. You're just not telling Google the right stuff for it to give it to you.
Oh, totally. I've had so many students who are like, I've Googled this thing over and over and over again. And, you know, I'm looking at it and I see exactly what the issue is. And I'm like, if I Googled this right now, I would find it. But they don't know how to Google it properly yet. And that's it's hard to get used to. And I think a lot of these things are honestly just time and doing them over and over again and recognizing the patterns that do work and recognizing the patterns that don't work. But then again, we can also give people some sneak hits in order to make that process a little faster.
Mm-hmm. How much do you find that like appropriate uses of historical context or like dropping in little bits of knowledge about how things used to be done? Sometimes we were talking about like hard drive performance. The analogy I was using, even though I'm old, was of a record player. And like, you know, you're talking about like hard drives and how hard drives move around. If you were trying to play a record, a music on a record, and, you know, let's say that the song was fragmented on the record, like the needle would have to actually get up and go looking for the rest of the song and get back down. You would probably like slow the beat down. It would probably make the song not sound right. And that analogy worked really well for some people, but for other people it didn't because it's an old analogy. But it provided historical context about like how heads move around a digital, you know, a hard drive.
Yeah. So I think knowing some of that stuff is really important. And teaching with analogies, I think, is also really important. The concept of linking, where you're taking what they know and then teaching them something really tiny based off of what they already know, and teaching it incrementally in that way is really important. And then I also think having analogies that fit your audience and are relevant for everybody is also something that's really important. Mm-hmm. I was really passionate about making sure that examples didn't fit into the like nerdy stereotypes. Mm. I noticed that a lot of people teach with like Star Wars or Lord of the Rings or Star Trek. I have never seen any of those things at all.
And blocked and reported. We're stopping.
I know. I definitely don't fit in the stereotypes at all. And so I would teach with like a Britney Spears fan app as one of my things. And it held people's attention so much because they thought it was super funny and super out there. And it also kind of speaks to a very different audience than maybe some of the other examples would have. So that's something that I really strongly believe in as well. I wrote an article earlier this year that was an introduction to linked lists based off of Ariana Grande's Thank You Next. Mm. And that kind of went crazy on Twitter and was definitely a really fun article to write. And if you look at like the analytics of who is reading it, it was really different than the normal tech audience, which I thought was really cool as well.
So that makes me wonder if I need to do something about like Intel processors as it relates to like Seven Rings.
I'm just saying.
There's like a thing there that could potentially be done. And this here's an interesting thing though, that like when it is an analogy on Tolkien or something Star Trek-y, people find that exclusionary. But if I, as a Star Trek fan or Star Wars fan, was in a tutorial and you did something on, you know, My Little Pony, Friendship is Magic, I would find that charming and awesome and I would totally roll with it. So it's interesting that some fandoms are somewhat exclusionary while others are more, you know, more cool. Like I would think a Britney Spears analogy would be awesome and I would be more engaged like you described.
Yeah, I think it's more just having a balance than totally cutting one type out. Mm. And I think that having those examples is great. It's just that the other examples should be in there as well, so that you're hitting all your different audiences instead of always appealing to one part of the room.
That's really cool. I talk about the importance of localizing your talk, and I don't mean picking a language, even though that's important. Who's your audience, and are all of your slides, your words, your analogies, your references going to land? You can't go, maybe you couldn't go and do that Britney Spears thing in another country where she wasn't popular.
Totally.
Yeah, and then find out whoever the Britney Spears of Bulgaria is, and then use that person for your app.
Totally. And then you get a pop culture primer in another country too.
Yeah, that's a great way to do things. So your new course that you're working on, Moving Past Tutorials, how long do you think it's going to take? And are you going to release it as it comes? Or is this something that we're going to wait a few months for?
Yeah, so I'm going to be releasing parts of it weekly so that I can iterate on feedback and build off of what people are liking, maybe minimize stuff that people aren't enjoying as much and really tailor it to the audience that comes from it. So it's going to be definitely incrementally pushed and I'm really excited about it. I am trying to make it appeal to as many learning styles as possible. So it's going to be video and visual and written and link out to other resources. So definitely we'll be trying to appeal to as many problem solvers as possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it'd be really helpful to be able to break down problems that we see in interviews. I have a friend who recently did not do well in an interview, not just because, you know, it's whiteboarding and it's uncomfortable and all that kind of usual interviews suck type stuff, but because the actual breaking down of a problem was complicated. It was about sorting coins. Like, imagine if coins are rolling down and they need to be sorted into particular buckets and stuff like that. And I think that if the breaking down was clearer and the tools available to you were clearer, it would have been a more successful interview.
Yeah, I agree. I think that the interview process is definitely broken, but there's also some validity that those problems are so difficult because they have such a huge problem-solving component to them, and that can really challenge people. And it's important to test those skills because that is what they're going to be using. And so, I mean, from an interviewer perspective, it's how do you test that in a fair way? Mm-hmm. But then on an interviewee perspective, it's how do I solve these problems accurately and really think about all the different components that go into it and all the edge cases that can happen and how to stay with it when they ask you the twist question a little bit further in. Mm-hmm.
Now, you said that you're going to be using using Python, your favorite language of choice, to do this. But the course is mostly language agnostic, so even though I'm not a big Python head, I'm going to be able to follow along.
Yes, so it's going to be totally language agnostic in that you can solve any of these problems in any programming language. The only reason I'm using Python is because the syntax of Python looks pretty similar to spoken word. Mm. And so I switch in between Python and JavaScript as my kind of two primary languages. Okay. JavaScript relies a lot more on symbols, whereas Python revolves more on like written word. Mm-hmm. And so I think that if somebody was looking at it, Python would look more like written word mm-hmm. or pseudocode.
That was my next question. It's kind of like pseudocode.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Where are people going to be able to check this out? They just go to dev.to and then Aspittle, and that's where they would follow you? Or is there a specific URL for it?
Totally. Dev2 Aspittle, and the post will be going up on there. It'll also be a series. So if you go to that starter post, everything will be linked off of that one.
Okay, cool. We're going to make sure that we've got links directly to, of course, your page, but also even after this podcast has been published, we'll make sure to put in additional links in the show notes. So if you're listening to this show, you can go down to the show notes and check it out, and we'll have links to Ali's work. Thanks so much for chatting with me today.
Awesome. Thank you.
This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.